We've heard that natural disasters do not discriminate. A storm, a flood, a drought, they're going to happen where they happen. But the policies that put certain people in the path of those disasters, yeah, they absolutely discriminate. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Around the world, there's the legacy of colonialism and resource exploitation. And here in the United States, people of color have historically faced restrictions around where they were allowed to live, own, and develop land, resulting not just in segregation, but in environmental racism, in which the wealthy and privileged communities push the burdens of pollution and climate hazards away from their own neighborhoods and into areas with less privilege. My guest believes the United States needs climate policy that takes a reparative stance. Manon Donahue is senior research associate at Brookings Metro and author, along with Andre M. Perry, of the report The Case for Climate Reparations in the United States. Manon, welcome to Think.
Thanks for having me. Thanks very much.
How is the destruction of our environment linked to the oppression of certain groups of human beings over time?
Right. I mean, throughout history, we've seen that the exploitation of people goes hand in hand with the extraction of resources. You see that throughout a history of colonialism, where colonizing nations extracted wealth using the exploitation of people, and then used that wealth and the resources from that extraction to build up more powerful economies, more higher emitting economies. Economies like the US, that's responsible for over 25% of all greenhouse gas emissions since the Industrial Revolution.
So colonialism set the world up for that kind of disparity even before we knew climate change existed.
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, and that's what we say, Andre and I, in this piece, is that it's important to think about that connection to colonial histories when we're thinking about designing climate policy today.
So the harms caused by climate change are potentially bad for every living thing on the planet. What do we now understand, though, about how the actual damage is distributed unequally in different places?
Yeah, that's exactly right. You see that there's differences, not so much in the severity of climate impacts, although there are differences around the world in where climate disasters like a hurricane or a storm surge or a large flood, where they affect different nations differently. But really the large difference is in climate vulnerability. And that's about your capacity to be resilient to adapt to climate impacts, and not to have adverse outcomes as a result of a big disaster. So countries like, for example, Bangladesh or Pakistan that have less wealth and have this history of colonial extraction, we see that they're much more vulnerable, much less able to respond to large climate disasters.
Talk for a minute about Pakistan, because they have just really been struggling since this enormous flood that I think many Americans may have, you know, thought about at the time it happened and not since.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, so this was in, I think, early or mid-2022. Pakistan was hit by some devastating floods, which resulted in tremendous loss of life and then also large damages to infrastructures, the things that people rely on to create a livelihood and to be prosperous people. And what we saw in that disaster, or as a result of that disaster, is the environment minister of Pakistan coming out and making this claim for reparations, kind of highlighting the fact that these large climate disasters were having different impacts in places like Pakistan, entrenching things like poverty to a much greater extent than in countries, say, like the U.S.
Right, because Pakistan contributes, like a fraction of 1% of annual global greenhouse gas emissions. They're not even a drop in the bucket.
Yeah, that's right. I think it's about 0.3% of all greenhouse gas emissions since the Industrial Revolution. Again, compared to the U.S., which I think is about 25%. And it's just a monumental difference, and really makes you pause to think, you know, who should be funding the responses to the variable impacts of climate change when you have such a different responsibility for the emissions.
So we can look at this on a couple of different scales. There's the global scale, we'll be talking about that, but within this country, environmental harms of all kinds are generally more severe in communities of color than majority white communities. Tell us about some of the reasons this has happened.
Right. I mean, you know, in the same way that you see this, the way that legacies of injustice in the international arena, the international sphere, have entrenched the vulnerability within certain countries who were colonized, you see a kind of parallel occurrence in the US, but instead linked to a history of enslavement in this country. And that's essentially the case we make in the paper, that these structurally racist policies dating back to enslavement, but then continuing on through policies of segregation and redlining that have had these racially biased outcomes, they've kind of done two things. And the first thing is that they've put communities of color predominantly into more exposed areas by and large, although that's not always the case. And by exposed, I mean more exposed to high heats, more exposed to flooding, more exposed to sea level rise. But then the more important thing that they've done is create a differential vulnerability. So again, they've things like the racial wealth gap, these also translate into a gap in resilience, a gap in climate resilience, in that your wealth, your security, your housing stability, all of these factors, they mediate the extent to which climate change is impacting your well-being and your costs and all of those other factors.
I mean, this is a problem for a number of reasons. You know, primarily it's just morally wrong that some people should absorb more of this than others. But it occurs to me that if the majority of these effects are being felt away from places where people have money and power, it's easier for those folks who might be in a position to change things to assume it's not going to be such a big deal as the climate continues to change.
Yeah, that's right. Exactly that. And as you say, there's a moral argument to be made, and that's indeed the case. It's definitely morally wrong. It's unjust to have a differential vulnerability. But then also, you know, from a quiet, from a policy effectiveness standpoint, it also doesn't make sense to have policies that perpetuate, say, a racial wealth gap, because they really do undermine the effectiveness of climate policy itself. Inequality and inequity, they're bad for effective climate policy.
When you call in this paper for a reparative stance toward climate change, what does that mean exactly?
Right. So really, by invoking reparations, what we're thinking here, reparations are really about an attempt to redress the differences in responsibilities for climate impacts, and then the differences in vulnerability that stem from legacies of injustice that are built on exploitation and extraction. Reparations, largely we've understood as a financial transfer of wealth, but they're a lot more than that. They're also about a moral reckoning. And really what we go on to push in the paper is more about a reparative stance than reparations itself. And what we mean by that is more about shifting towards more anti-racist and more an approach to climate policy, particularly around adaptation and resilience, more built on addressing inequity and injustice.
How important is it that a reparative stance also causes the most polluting entities to feel they're being punished for what they've done?
Right. Yeah, it's interesting when you start to talk about climate reparations or reparations in general, there's always a question of who's accountable here. And, you know, I'm sure my colleague Andre Perry would agree that, you know, at this point, perhaps it doesn't matter too much where the funding for climate resilience and adaptation are coming from. Although I do agree, I want to make that clear, that I think large corporations and large polluters do have a large role to play in funding climate resilience. But what's more important is that we shift towards a policy approach which recognizes the importance of financial and housing security, for example, and access to healthcare as really pillars of effective climate policy.
How do environmental activists think climate reparations could work on an international scale? We'll talk about the domestic stuff in a bit, but what would this look like globally?
Right. So globally, I mean, this is an important point, is that the arguments for climate reparations, or at least the structure that they may take, could be somewhat different internationally to domestically. Internationally, we saw a breakthrough at COP27. COP27 is the international climate forum that happens every year, where members, representatives of countries get together and try to set an agenda on climate action. And what we saw at the most recent COP was the passing of this loss and damage funds. And what this is a fund of contributions largely by previously colonizing nations, largely developed nations, to help support historically colonized nations and lower income countries when a climate disaster occurs. It's important to say that's not really strictly climate reparations, in that it's forward looking. It's not backwards looking. It's not looking to account for the historic injustices, but it does take a step towards that, in that the fund is acknowledging that there are these historical connections from vulnerability today to historic injustice of the past.
So what's involved in sorting out which countries will pay these monies and which countries might receive them?
Yeah, that's a really big question. And I honestly don't have a great answer for you there. It's, again, to come back to COP27, what you did see is that countries like the US and Australia, where I'm from, looked to avoid this reparations language. There was some pushback on that, largely probably because to try to avoid being on the hook financially for legacies of impacts. But so there's a large conversation. That's all to say that there's a large conversation going on internationally around who should be contributing and who should benefit. One of the largest questions around there is how you treat, say, a country like China that is a huge emitter now, but has also had this this connection to historical injustice as well. And there's some other examples, for example, like Brazil, these large growing economies which are now contributing disproportionately to greenhouse gases.
Can countries be compelled by international law to pay this kind of money? I mean, I wonder, what it's going to take to convince anyone that they're responsible.
Right. Can countries be compelled by international law? Yeah, that's a huge question. And I wish I had a better answer for you. But by and large, it's challenging. And international approaches to develop financial mechanisms that help to transfer money from wealthy nations to poorer nations, they haven't always worked that well in the past, partly because of this, because a lot of international policy lacks teeth. It's dependent upon the agreement of participating countries. It's very challenging to get to have any kind of a policy that's really enforceable.
There's also this question of who gets to decide how the money is spent. I would imagine countries that are shelling out want to dictate the use of those funds.
Yeah, exactly right. That is an important question. Another one of these sticky questions, which our international networks to develop climate policy are not necessarily or not has have historically been the best at answering. One interesting initiative has been the Bridgetown agenda led by Mia Motley of Barbados. And this is, this is kind of a way trying to push past those traditional barriers in international development and say, hey, we need not only new ways or more funding, we actually need new mechanisms to help funding get from one country to another, which aren't as connected to debt, say, for example.
Menon, domestically, you think an ideal place to start would be offering reparations to Black Americans and land reclamation for Indigenous Americans. As you note, this is a moral responsibility first and foremost. How might that kind of funding help these communities adapt to the impact of climate change they're already feeling?
Right. So, as I said before, we know that differences in wealth, financial security, housing security, your relative costs of your electricity, and these kinds of things, healthcare costs. All of these mediate the effects of, or the impacts of climate change, and they make you more vulnerable. So a policy which helps to bridge those gaps, to bridge gaps in wealth, help to bridge gaps in climate resilience as well. So as well as being a moral action, that's a practical solution to help build the adaptive capacity and the resilience of some of our most vulnerable communities in the US.
Have you thought about what the balance might be for these groups between like escaping now hazardous environments for safer places as opposed to staying behind and using resources to improve the ecosystems in these places?
Yeah, look, I mean, I think there's some cases across the US where certain areas are just going to become too exposed, too dangerous to really live in. You can look at my colleague, Jenny Schutz, you can look at her work on housing to have a look at that in more detail. But second to that, I also want to say that, and this is what we're trying to push as well in this reparative stance, is that it's important to act with communities as well. The people who are on the front lines of climate change tend to have the best idea of how it's affecting their lives and what kind of intervention could help them to manage or weather the impacts of climate change better. So I think it's important to front that up and actually talk to people in those communities and collaborate with them to develop adaptive solutions.
You've alluded to this briefly already, but I want to go into it in more detail. You note that our long history of enslaving people in this country ironically brought in the wealth that was used to rapidly industrialize the United States and pull resources from the environment. Talk us through how that worked.
Right. What we have with, you know, enslavement is really this process of the exploitation of people, the extraction of their labor, and the use of that labor to develop industry within the US. Of course, the US went on to become the highest emitting nation in the history of the globe. Off the back of this extracted labor from enslavement, we know that at the time it was the most profitable industry within the US and really drove that the industrialization and the transference of the US into a large, dominating, high emitting economy.
And even after enslavement ended, places found different ways to generate wealth and by industrializing. You note that Louisiana was once like a really big sugar growing capital,
right.
And then converted to oil extraction after the Civil War.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Louisiana is an interesting case. You see that the exact same lands, or not exact same, but the lands which were used for plantation economies were the same lands then that oil and gas came into, industrial factories came into, and are now emitting high toxic pollutants, which are hurting the descendants of some of those same communities. In other words, you almost have this continuation of extraction from one type of economy to another, but in large part still having these disproportionate impacts on the same or similar communities.
You also remind us that virtually all the land used in this country for greenhouse gas producing activities and toxic resource extraction like mining, that all came from land originally belonging to native peoples. How can land reclamation work when, according to sort of current law, much of it is owned by private individuals? How's that going to work?
How is land reclamation going to work? That's a really good question. And again, it's not something that I necessarily have a great answer to. Again, I would point, I guess I would start by saying, you know, it's important to acknowledge that history, that the US is built on somewhat on a history of land theft. And that wrapped up in that exploitation of people, there was this process of development. And today that's distributed where people are vulnerable, including indigenous peoples of the US. The case for land rights, I know this is a contentious thing, and different indigenous peoples groups will have different opinions on what's important and what's necessary to help enact more positive change amongst those communities. And again, I don't speak for those communities, and I come back to it's important to include them in dialogues in how best this process can happen.
A lot of these communities, particularly Indigenous folks, are really leading the charge on calling for these kinds of reparations, right?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, historically around the world, I think since at least 20 or 30 years ago, Indigenous peoples internationally have led the call for climate reparations globally based off this history of colonialism that has affected Indigenous peoples to a great extent.
What makes the process of doing something like climate reparations, or as you say, taking a reparative stance on climate, different from the forms of reparations that we've been debating in this country for decades?
Right. Yeah, reparations is exactly right. Reparations can come in many forms. And when you ask somebody what is reparations, they can have quite different answers for you. You know, a common idea of reparations is that it is a settlement model where you're transferring wealth or resources from one group to another. What actually we're advocating for in this piece is more of, while financial transfer is important, it's also important to have a broader reckoning with this linked history between climate vulnerability on the one hand and the history of structural racism on the other.
How might we create lending practices that work as a form of climate reparations?
The lending practices question is interesting, and I'm not going to stand here and pretend I'm an expert on international lending practices. It can be somewhat of a confusing topic. But there has been a call internationally by some groups to challenge the traditional way that we engage in international development through lending, premised upon lending creating debt traps for certain countries and the people therein that can actually entrench poverty rather than lead to its amelioration.
And what is an atonement model of reparations?
Right. An atonement model is more a model which is about envisaging better policies, more about atoning, first and foremost, about recognizing those historic links and the importance that they still play today. It's particularly relevant in the US, where we know that race and not income or wealth is the biggest predictor of climate impacts. An atonement model is really trying to take that seriously, take that history of wealth extraction seriously, and say, you know, that's part of our history. What can we then do to develop new policies which actually move beyond that, which actually look to change the distribution of inequality and inequity within this country?
Are there countries in the world that are doing this well already? Are there places we could look to for guidance?
No, this is still largely an emerging topic internationally, as it is within the US. There's not many good countries that I can point to that have acted on this particularly well. Other countries are better, however, at providing income floors, for example, or providing, or I should say, more recognizing the linkages between vulnerability to climate impacts and wider financial and housing security.
Speaking of security in a different context, if we don't start to pretty quickly address ongoing climate damage, how might these disasters start to pose threats to the national security of the countries that are hardest hit?
Mm-hmm. That's right. I mean, climate disasters, the loss and damage of climate disasters is increasing and has been trending upwards since at least the 1980s, which is, I think, when NOAA has data going back to. Climate disasters are becoming more costly. The impacts are lasting for longer, and they're becoming more likely to entrench negatively adversely negative outcomes. For example, like entrenching poverty in certain households and communities. As you have these impacts, which are making more people poorer, bringing people into poverty, while others who have the financial security to insulate themselves from those effects, you're going to see a widening of wealth inequality, a widening of inequity, without an active and strategic policy that looks to bridge those gaps. And as you highlight, that's from a security perspective, that's not good. Income inequality isn't good for national security, and it undermines national stability.
We have been talking about economic reparations for the descendants of enslaved Americans for many years now, Manon, and they've really not come to much. Is there reason to think that broadening this conversation, having more serious discussions about global climate reparations, might move the needle on this other kind of reparations in the United States?
My opinion on it is optimistic, yes. And I'm gonna, front up here and say I'm an Australian, right? I'm actually not from this country, and my background is more in international climate policy. But speaking to that, what you can see in international climate policy is really this momentum for a new approach to climate policy, which is premised upon justice and equity. And this isn't a fringe movement. This is really pushed by large organizations like the World Bank, like the ILO, and like the IPCC, which is the international body of scientists that have helped to craft policies on climate change from a research base. And by seeing that large normalization of this approach gives me hope that a country like the US will also take that seriously and start to see reparations as not only something which is important to do morally to atone for that history, but also something to do practically to help address climate impacts more effectively.
What will it take, do you think, to convince lawmakers in the countries most responsible for climate change to pay up? I'm thinking about how, surely lawmakers will always be inclined to talk about the pressing need for domestic spending over international spending. This is, no matter what we spend money on overseas, it is always more controversial than money spent at home.
Right. Again, I come back to that moral imperative. There's a moral argument to be had that countries like the US, who bear a disproportionate level of responsibility, ought to be a leader here in acting internationally to fund climate adaptation. And then also to set an example domestically as well and say, we're also addressing these problems at home and they share a common history. That moral argument, unfortunately, in the past has not always pushed countries to act and contribute more. Something interesting I think we're seeing now is also more of a competitive race to act more on climate mitigation, for example, invest more in climate mitigation and then gain a competitive edge. So it may be that we see an acceleration of international action on climate change also in response to that, to more economic pressures as well.
That's an interesting way to frame this, gaining a competitive edge, because I think so often we think about the payments like this and we think about what we have to lose. You're saying there's a lot we have to gain by taking action on this.
Yeah, exactly. One side of it is on climate mitigation, which is about reducing the amount of greenhouse gases that we're emitting. That's a high technological industry, which there's lots of investment at the moment. I'll give you my personal opinion on this. As we get closer and closer to the precipice of impacts, looking over and seeing just how dire the circumstances can be, the need to invest rapidly into changing the systems that we have becomes more and more important, also from an existential perspective, from a survival perspective. And I think we're starting to see some of that take over. But what I want to say second to that as well is that along the way, it's important to continue engaging with justice. How can we make these interventions, especially in climate mitigation, maintain a just approach, an equitable approach that doesn't leave people behind. And that's my worry, is that as you have a more competitive investment in especially climate mitigation, how do you also have a more meaningful engagement with making sure that these changes deliver positive outcomes to everybody?
Do you have a sense of how to do that?
Do I have a sense of how to do that? I mean, again, it's a big question. And what we really put forth in this paper is it comes back to, on the one hand, a real reckoning with the histories there to help you develop more progressive policies by looking at the past and what's happened in the past and what hasn't worked in the past. For example, in the US, we know that something like the Clean Air Act, it reduced overall, or is said to have reduced overall air pollution by about 60 to 66%, I think. But over the same time, we've seen air quality worsen, or the distribution of air quality, sorry, become more inequitable, and communities of color bearing a disproportionate burden of air pollution. So that's a lesson that we can learn from that lesson and say, okay, we've been successful at reducing overall pollution, but now we need to come up with policies that help to target distributions as well, and not just aggregate emissions reduction.
Manon, is there just a straight up fiscal case to be made for taking action sooner rather than later on climate mitigation anywhere in the world?
Yeah, there definitely is. The impacts of climate change, the loss and damage from climate change are increasing. They're trending upwards, and they have been for a long time. I believe the impacts, the loss and damage from climate-related disasters in the US in 2022, I think it was $168 billion in damages. And I think it's been about $2.3 trillion in damages since 1980. These are huge, huge numbers, and they're an underestimate. What they don't account for are all of the kind of hidden costs. For example, how climate change raises the cost of healthcare by making people more vulnerable. The way that it raises the cost of electricity bills, because you have to heat your home more than you did in the past, or you have to cool it more than you did in the past because of heat waves. All of these costs on households and individuals and communities, they're not in that figure. So again, if anything, that's an underestimate. It makes sense from a fiscal perspective to try to do what we can to lower those costs as early as possible. And one way to do that is by helping to make communities less vulnerable now. Reparations are an investment in people and communities through a financial transfer, and through that transfer, helping to lower climate vulnerability as well.
What is climate gentrification?
What is climate gentrification? Climate gentrification is a word I see buzzing around more and more recently. And I'll go back to something more definitional. And what kind of what it comes back to is this difference in vulnerability versus exposure. So in communities where historically, say for example in Miami, it's been the lower income communities that have lived not on sea level but on higher grounds, while those communities aren't so exposed to climate impacts, they're still vulnerable to the indirect impacts of climate change, for example by being priced out of their neighborhoods, because as it becomes less safe to be living in the lower lying areas, your assets are devalued because you're more likely to be a victim of or be impacted by sea level rise. You're seeing this influx of higher income people wanting to move to the less exposed areas and then displacing the historic residents of those places. So climate gentrification is this phenomenon of people moving and displacing residents in trying to seek out less exposed areas. And it really speaks to the importance of thinking about vulnerability, not just exposure, when we're thinking about climate impacts.
We're talking really specifically about climate effects today. However, there is also the reality that the United States, in its consumer spending habits, sort of pushes other environmental effects to other countries, right? You know, factories emitting toxic smoke that may be located somewhere in Asia, mines to, you know, get the materials we need to build cell phones. Does it make sense to wrap those environmental effects in with these climate questions, or do they really need to be treated separately?
No, I think it makes sense to wrap them up together. These things are connected, they're interconnected, and it's important to think about them as such.
What I want to underline for folks is that what I don't hear you saying here is that we need to shut down all industry all over the world, that we need to sort of go back to a pre-industrialized way of living. Some of the ways we do things may need to change, but you're not talking about kind of a radical restructuring of every modern convenience.
Right. I think, so from my perspective, it is important to think about aggregate emissions, how much we're emitting, and you know, a supply side policy that helps to reduce the amount of fossil fuels that we're digging out of the grounds, and thus the emissions that we're putting into the atmosphere. It's important to regulate that and reduce the level of emissions that we're producing. I think we do need transformative change, but I don't necessarily think that always needs to be radical. And I think you can have effective transformative change without completely destabilizing individuals' lives and livelihoods.
Something really interesting that comes up in this report, interesting and disturbing, is that as things stand now, when so-called natural disasters occur in the United States, generally, it is wealthy and white people who receive the most funding to make things better in the aftermath. Why does that happen?
Right. Yeah, that's quite a perverse outcome. And what you're seeing there is this: these results that have shown that post-disaster, low-income, largely communities of colors, see wealth declines over time, whereas majority white communities tend to see wealth increases. It's difficult to entangle exactly what's to unentangle, sorry, exactly what's going on there. There's a lot of potential factors, but one of the outcomes may be that you're not, because of a historic devaluation of majority community of color neighborhoods, you're not seeing the same kind of post-disaster investment flows into those communities. Instead, you're seeing more of a push to leave those communities rather than reinvest and rebuild them.
So does that explain why you think colorblind approaches to correcting those inequities are likely to fail?
Yeah, exactly right. I mean, this is the kind of outcome where you've got a policy that is obviously set up to try to do something good, to try to lower the impact of climate disasters on individuals and on communities, but actually ends up having these inadvertently negative outcomes because it's failed to think about, from a distributional perspective, how this policy is going to affect people.
How might fixing racial financial inequality reduce the costs of responding to climate change?
We see in the US really large wealth gaps along lines of race. I think it's about 7.5 times is the difference in wealth between white Americans and Black Americans. Those wealth gaps, they translate to gaps in the ability to have a secure and stable well-being, from your ability to pay for your rent to your ability to invest and grow your wealth, to pass on to future generations, all of these effects. And again, those tie into your ability to withstand climate shocks, your ability to cope after a disaster, or even just your ability to cover the financial costs of withstanding a heat wave, or the health impacts. So again, to say again, addressing those financial gaps is good policy, good adaptation, climate adaptation policy to help people raise their adaptive capacity.
Can you talk about what we should understand about the Biden administration's Justice 40 initiative?
Yeah, the Biden administration has clearly signaled a strong willingness to want to act on both climate policy and on policy which improves racial equity. The Justice 40 initiative, this is an initiative to ensure that 40% of federal funding benefits historically disadvantaged or historically marginalized communities. And it's an attempt to make the Inflation Reduction Act, which is the biggest climate history, to make that act and the outcomes of that act more just.
You also note California's cap and trade greenhouse gas emissions market. How successful has that been in reinvesting the proceeds into making a better environment for California residents?
Right. I mean, I don't know the intricacies of that policy in a whole lot of detail, but just to say, this is another one of these, and here a state-based attempt to try to think about the distributional impacts of a policy. In this case, to take a climate policy and help to reinvest some of the monetary outcomes of this cap and trade scheme and put it back into low-income communities. As I understand, that program doesn't target for race. I believe it only targets for income and wealth, but still, that's a good policy, which is trying to think about strategically, how do we make a policy that benefits historically disadvantaged communities?
So we've talked a lot so far about the responsibility of governments that are generating large amounts of greenhouse gases and other environmental damage. How do we drill down to accurately assess the accountability of like corporations?
How do we assess the accountability of corporations? That's a big question. I don't think I have a great answer for you there, but I will say that it shouldn't just be the federal government's responsibility to fund climate responses. It should also be in part the responsibility of the largest emitters as well. The largest corporate emitters. In terms of developing financial mechanisms to help transfer some of the funds from those companies into affected communities, that's a whole nother kettle of fish. That's a huge question.
To the extent that we want to encourage involvement from the most affected individuals and communities, the people who are suffering most from the effects of climate change, what does that look like? How can we give these folks meaningful input into the ways that we're addressing the problems that affect them?
Right. I think historically, the approach has been somewhat tokenistic to go in communities and consult. But what really should be happening is a much more collaborative engagement where you're approaching affected communities, communities of color, low-income communities, and giving them a seat at the table, not just to sit at the table, but to be able to speak at the table. To actually make an active contribution into the creation of policy for their communities.
You stress here that the United States really needs to expand climate adaptation beyond disaster preparedness and beyond disaster response. When I read that, it occurred to me that we're so focused on those things that folks may be left with the question of what else is there?
Right. That's right. Historically, US disaster policy, I mean, sorry, US climate policy, and we also see this in other parts of the world, targets disaster policy, doesn't target, and not only that, targets disaster policy, but also targets impacts that loss and damage, sorry, of disasters after they occur, rather than targeting for building up people's ability to withstand those disasters before they occur. So really, and that's what you're seeing internationally is this shift towards away from a conversation of disaster, managing disasters, and towards investing in communities and individuals to build up their capacity to withstand disasters. And then second to that, I would say what else is important is not just about disasters, but to think about the other aspects of climate change, the way that it can change, for example, your ability to pay for your housing costs, your ability to find adequate and meaningful employment. The effects of climate change run deep. They affect all different spheres of life, and it's not just about disaster impacts.
The United States is not just demographically and economically diverse. We have, you know, so many different kinds of topography and local conditions. What Miami needs to solve its climate-related problems may be very different from what Kansas needs. What does localized adaptation look like?
Right. Yeah, that's a really important point. And it comes back to this point about vulnerability, that different communities are uniquely vulnerable in different ways. On the one hand, because they're differently exposed to different kinds of climate disasters, but then also because the factors which are affecting quality of life in those locations may also be different. So a more localized approach to resilience is really about working with those communities, with leaders in those communities, with not-for-profits in those communities, to understand what are both the most pressing climate impacts, and then also what are the most pressing social impacts as well. What challenges are people facing, and how are they affecting the way in those specific communities the people are able to respond to climate change?
Manon Donohue is Senior Research Associate at Brookings Metro and co-author of the report, The Case for Climate Reparations in the United States. Manon, thanks so much for making time to talk about this.
Thank you very much. I really appreciate it.
Find us on Facebook and Instagram, or download the podcast where you get podcasts, or listen at our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.